You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live to the cosmos from the backyard at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you dirty rat. Got me on this corner. Don't know where I'm at. Supposed to meet my baby. I'm 20 minutes late. You got my head all twisted, and I just can't get it straight. Vicious, vicious vodka.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45. Going to be joined today in the studio with Maxime Bellet, co-author of Modernist Cuisine Cookbook. Also, oh, here he is. He's coming through right now. I see him. So I'll wait to introduce him. We're also here with Dana. Hey, Dana, what's your last name?
Goodyear
from The New Yorker. She's just hanging out, but she's welcome to chime in anytime she wants. You put on a pair of headphones. This one's for you.
Okay.
Right? And as usual, we're joined with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, who's sitting typing on her computer, getting stuff done for the Cooking Issues machine. Am I right?
That's true.
Yeah?
It's
yeah.
Berlin.
Yeah. So, hey, Maxime. Here, pull up a seat. Here's your microphone and your headphones. So, Maxime, I'm doing well. Maxine, you were a graduate of what? Of ICE? Originally our arch nemesis, the FCI. Is that true? Or
indeed, ICE.
Yeah.
Very brief stint at ICE.
Yeah, that's our arch nemesis. But then moved to what anyone who was hanging around in New York in, I guess, the late 90s, early 2000s, Jack's Oyster Bar, right? Fantastic place. Didn't you work there?
I did. I actually went to Jack's Luxury Oyster Bar as a stagiaire directly from ICE. The chef left about 2 weeks later. And Jack Lamb, crazy as he is, gave me the head chef job. So it was quite a transition for a young chef.
But a great, I mean, I went, I think, once, but it moved across the street, right? I went when it was on its original side of the street,
yes,
and I think once when it was across the street.
Yeah, I was there when it was still the little carriage house. And
right.
Then it moved to the old Makimono space.
Where was that, on Fifth Street?
It's on Fifth Street.
Yeah. Anyway, fabulous place, great pedigree. Went moved from there to the Fat Duck, you know, the Heston Blumenthal's famous joint, right?
Indeed.
And you were on the restaurant side or the development side? The development side.
I began on the restaurant side, and then they quickly moved me to the development side. That was my, you know, my calling. All the research and the you know great dishes that Heston would push us to create.
And then was tapped by Nathan Miravol to be a part of the Modernist Cuisine Dream Team. And so, you know, the three authors on the book, of course, Nathan, who's been on the show before, Nathan Miravol, Chris Young, good friend of ours, been on the show before, and Maxime, for the first time on the show. Well, welcome.
It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Dana, who, again, may or may not chime in, I don't know, welcome to, is writing an article on strange meats. True or false?
True.
All right. Very good.
Nice.
So listen, call all of your questions in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So how you doing? Maxime was at our bar the other day.
I loved it. Oh my God. You were right. The basil cocktail, it's delicious. It's so fragrant.
Thanks, I appreciate it. It's a technique we do at Booker and Dax, which basically, we just lost, by the way, Best New Bar, Time Out in New York, to a Maison Premier, but it's good to lose to such a great bar, Maison Premier. Anyway, technique where we smash the Thai basil with liquid nitrogen, and what happens is when it's frozen that deeply in liquid nitrogen, there's no sort of enzymatic degradation of the herb at all, and we can shatter it into super, super fine particles, even just using a hand muddler, then add liquor directly. That prevents the enzymes, because the enzymes can't really work in high-proof liquor.
Absolutely. You get that beautiful extraction.
Yeah, and it's like the liquor sucks it straight out, and then lime juice, the ascorbic acid, further prevents breakdown by enzymes, and then shake it like a normal daiquiri from there on out. But I like it. It's a good
drink. The color is beautiful, but the aroma is just, yeah.
Yeah,
spectacular.
So before I get into questions, and I hate to do this to you, because everyone always asks this is the question I have to ask you, and if I don't ask you, someone will get upset at me.
By all means.
What's next on your plate?
Well, right now it's been the book tour. It's been an incredible journey, you know, just sharing, teaching, you know, every different technique and all the aesthetics that we went into creating Modernist Cuisine, we're able to share on so many levels. It's just so much information, and we're by having this book tour, we're able to sort of unravel it and look at the different aspects that went into its making. But going forward, we've had many propositions, and we're not totally clear exactly what the next phase is. We have a little project in the works that will come out soon. That's kind of exciting. But that's just, that's, I'm going to give you a teaser on that one. And
you're not allowed to tell me any more specifics on it?
No.
All right.
You know, at AV, they make you sign giant NDAs. And
where?
Intellectual Ventures.
Oh, really? Oh, that's it.
So I am bound by.
All right. Well, just, you know, dropping it there that there is something coming. We just don't know what it is. Yeah. Thanks for making me curious now and not giving me anything. maybe off air.
My full intention.
Yeah. Well, you know, by the way, in case you have randomly tuned to this podcast and don't know what Modernist Cuisine is, it is probably the single kind of greatest cookbook publishing phenomenon of all times. Probably, I would have to say,
Dave,
of all times.
Well, that's very flattering.
Yeah. Next to me, for instance, right? Apicius is the only book on Roman cookery. It's not that it's a great book,
sure,
but it's the only book. Right now, we have a huge output of cookbooks and food-related books, and yet nothing that has ever been attempted, much less successfully produced on this scale. It's amazing. I mean, anyway, astounding book.
Thank you.
You know, and the thing is that even though I guess the going Amazon price is what, about $450 now?
About $400.
Yeah, so it's not an inexpensive book, but
no.
As Nathan is fond of pointing out, a lot of paper in that book.
A lot of paper, and very good investment per, you know, the amount of information you're getting. I mean, if you think about it, it's five volumes. You break it down, it's. And the amount of work that went into it, I think it's, you know, as a young chef, as a passionate foodie, whatever you want to call, you know, yourself, it's, I think it's a very good investment for your future creative culinary adventures.
But it's less than half the price per book of the Albuli books, for instance.
Yes,
if you're going to compare.
If you would, yeah, exactly.
If you want to compare,
if that's the reference.
Yeah, and what's funny about it, not to speak on such venal terms about it, but, you know, everyone's wondering, well, you know, Nathan, who has an unbelievable amount of money, an absurd amount of money, really, when you think about it. He's a rich man.
He's very well. He's done very well for himself,
yeah,
and he's worked hard for it.
Well, I'm not saying anything negative about it. He's got a lot of money. He's, you know, multi-billionaire. But everyone was like, well, you know, this is kind of one of the criticisms you hear is that it's just because he has a lot of money, he's never going to make the money back. But in fact, the book is good enough.
It's
making the money
actually
back.
It's actually becoming on the edge of profitable, and that was never the intention. But you know, we thought we would sell 2,000 copies maybe, and now we're almost at 30,000 copies. And at that price point, yeah, we're recuperating the investment that was made, and that's amazing.
I mean, the fact that it's actually going to be a profitable book,
yeah,
I think, is the greatest sign of. I mean, look, success in terms of kind of the impact that it's going to make in the world. The fact that something can be at that cost, can have that much money dumped into its production, right?
Yep.
Which Nathan will never divulge what the actual number is, but we know it's a lot because, I mean, at minimum, you had at least 15, you know, very very qualified people working full time for how many years, plus then a lot more,
at least three and a half, you had a full team,
and then a lot more than the 15 for a big chunk of that time
for the final year push when we really had to get everything together. It was almost 40, you know, including all the ghostwriters and the copy editors, and it was a pretty, you know, massive team of experts in, you know, in what they did.
Yeah, and so for something of that magnitude to be able to break even, just I think goes to show kind of how ripe the time was for this information, the need for the book, and also, you know, it's just, I think it's an interesting measure. So one that's often not talked about, actually, when people talk about the book, they don't talk about that aspect of
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. No, and I'm glad you bring that up, because in terms of timing and people being, you know, open to what this means, you know, that merging of art and science, which is a beautiful thing. And it's something that you know, a lot of classic traditionalists, you know, wanting to reject, and at the same time, when you embrace it, you realize that each really enhances the other, and it's such a clean, beautiful relationship that it was primed for that, and people are responding that way, and so that's a testament to the progress we've made with looking at the different roles of food.
And something else, I think I might have commented on this show about it before. I'm not sure. I can't remember. If you haven't seen the book at all, one of the interesting things about it is, and this is something I hadn't expected before I was able to see it, is kind of how personal it is. It's not, in other words, it's not the Encyclopedia Britannica.
It's not a cold textbook. By no means.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of personal feelings, personal. I mean, it's
some humor. A lot of personal aspects.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great book. Anyway, so we have a question on the book. Someone who read actually from Zymergy, the blog, I guess.
Yeah.
Had a question regarding the Spätzle recipe in the book, and I'll read it. Even though it's addressed to me,
yes.
I'll read it to you, since you're going to know a lot more about it than I do. I've attempted the Modernist Cuisine sour cream Spätzle recipe twice now with less than desirable results, so you're going to troubleshoot this.
Let's fix this one.
All right. The issues are that they will not form into a shape. The first time I attempted them, they basically dissolved into the ice water. The second time, I received a new batch of Activa YG. By the way, that's meat glue. It's actually like a protein bonder. YG is the one that's made for dairy and protein stuff. Made the recipe and split the batch in two. I then used a... Before we go on, why don't you describe the recipe first so that people know what we're talking about.
Yeah, so this is actually a recipe inspired by Alex Naki from Ideas in Food. And we really, as part of our beef cheek goulash, we wanted to have a modernist special component. And so that was the basis for creating the recipe. And it's a combination of, I think it's cream cheese. I have to look at the recipe in front of me to be fully aware of
the
information. But basically, it's a dairy based Spätzle where we're using the binding properties of Activa YG. We also use an additional element of protein. There's albumin in there, and what you create is these very fluffy little dumplings that. After being set with that enzymatic process, then are nicely toasted in brown butter and served as a garnish for this you know very unctuous 72-hour beef cheek.
All right, and so the proteins in it, egg proteins, I guess, proteins, and also
the dairy proteins.
The dairy proteins are being bound together with an enzyme, transglutaminase, and meat glue.
Yep.
Set and then poached and then toasted, or
they're never actually poached. What we do is we sieve them after they've once the enzymatic process has begun. We sieve them into through a Spätzle maker into ice water. And you get these nice little dumpling shapes,
and then you
give them a final fry to really, give them that textural contrast.
So the first time that Red made them, it dissolved into the ice water. The second time, received a new batch of the Activa YG, made them and split the batch in two, used one quarter of the batch as directed with the same results, let the other half set in the fridge for 24 hours, thinking that it needed time to set up.
Yeah.
That was also not the answer. By the way, protein gel made with Activa, once set, if it's broken, it's broken.
You're breaking a gel, absolutely.
Yeah. So as pointed out, that was not the answer, because that won't work.
No.
The last quarter of the batch went into the freezer, another failure. I can attest that I'm following the recipe to the letter, but cannot seem to get this one down. I'm not sure if you know the formulation or not, but anything that you could add would be helpful. Gelatin, water, sour cream, ricotta, whey protein, isolate. There's gelatin in it too.
There's gelatin. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
we wanted to give a maximum amount of protein capacity.
How come you don't do a, you know, how come? The cold water then sets the gelatin,
yes.
And then the gelatin's cross-linked by the YG.
Exactly.
So I would bet that they're not. I would bet that you're not. They're not waiting long enough for the gelatin to get syrupy.
That's right. Yeah, that's a very good point. When you have your base mixture, letting the gelatin hydrate, doing that over an ice water bath until it gets that syrupy consistency, and then setting it directly into the ice water is one of the tricks.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people, one of the great meat glue applications involving gelatin is my brother-in-law, Wiley Dufresne's veg noodles and quinoa chips.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people have trouble duplicating that recipe. And I think 99% of the time, it's because they're not getting the gelatin.
The hydration and
I mean, one of the interesting things about a lot of these techniques is they really do require. As sometimes it is helpful to see people do it,
absolutely,
because there's a lot of like the hand in it. I know that Wiley also used to do very kind of a well-known in WD-50, a well-known recipe where he would take carrot and cardamom. Carrot, and then he would freeze it and dip it in a mixture of kappa carrageenan and locust bean gum to make his egg yolk.
They make the yolk with the egg white.
Yeah, the egg white was a coconut
like LBG.
Yeah. A very famous WD-50 dish.
Which we have in the book.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
But the truth is, it's actually a very difficult recipe if you've never done it before. It takes a lot of practice to get those egg yolks to work properly. And when you're first doing it, you'll get like 1 in 8 will work. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And then by the time, you know, you've been doing service every day for a month, you lose 1 in 20. Do you know what I mean? But there was always like the one cook in the kitchen who their job was to do all 60 of those every day, get them plated, get them away, and you know, they had the magic touch, but it really comes from practice. So a lot of these things take some practice.
Exactly. It's a huge amount of practice.
Yeah.
And feel and, you know, exactly.
So listen, call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. We're going to go to commercial break. Be right back with Maxime Bellet, Cooking Issues.
All right.
Booker T and the MGs, nice. Coming back with Cooking Issues, Maxime Bellet, caller, you are on the air.
Hi, Dave, thanks. I don't know how relevant my question is to your modernist show today, but I'm charged with making some dairy-free mashed potatoes for this weekend.
Ooh.
And I've seen some recipes online that basically call for, like, chicken broth or some milk substitute, like soy milk or almond milk, to simulate the creaminess, like, that dairy would... to mashed potatoes, and I was wondering if you had any alternative suggestions.
How long do you have from now?
How long do I have?
Yeah, how long do you have to get the recipe together from today?
I mean, I'm making them Friday night.
What do you think, Maxime? I would go for like an emulsion. I would do like a...
Vegetable. I mean, if you really want the creaminess, you have to have some vegetable oil base. And... I'm not sure what starch you would use.
I mean, if you were going to do... I mean, you can almost get like a mixture of gum arabic and xanthan, like the ticklodoid
we
use.
You could do that one.
And you could do a very heavy oil water emulsion.
Yeah.
That'll hold as it dilutes or as it's mixed with a solid, and you could get some of that... You'll get some of that creaminess, and you could just choose a delicious oil.
I wonder if you could do a slurry of the the potato flakes, hydrate them just a little bit, and then blend in the vegetable oil and make that your fat base.
I'm a little worried that if you don't pre-emulsify it, that it might break.
It could, but it depends on the ratio. If you're doing like the Robuchon or like very high
50%,
fat, 50% fat. But if you want the unctuousness, I mean, you know, even 15-20% fat, I think the amount of starch that you already have in the potato will act as a pretty good emulsifier for a vegetable oil base.
Have you tried just a vegetable oil base yet?
I really haven't even played around with it that much. I've just kind of started looking into it right now.
All right, well, first I would go bonehead simple, like we said, and just, you know, make mashed potatoes and beat put oil into it. I mean...
Gently.
Obviously. Put it through like a... I mean, like, don't turn it to glue.
No,
yes.
Please, no chewing gum mashed potatoes.
Yeah. And then after that, my next step would be to move into... something like like a Tickle Oil, like a xanthan gum arabic mix.
That's a great thing.
Hey, what about like does it have to be dairy free and completely, like, what about eggs? We combine with like an egg yolk and then
no, eggs are fine. Egg yolk would be great. Passover and
at the last second,
meat,
you, like a carbonara style, where you just get that richness.
Eggs are fine. You know, just no dairy, basically.
I think, you know, yeah, you could go like old school, like almost using the egg yolk, like super thick, but like
egg yolk instead of the gum arabic and xanthan, just to
as your emulsifier. Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's going to add some of the emulsifiers that you would not.
Yeah, it's, you're basically making a mayonnaise and folding it in. I mean, it's exactly that.
Yeah, I think if you're allowed to use egg, but just make sure you don't get the temperature too high again.
Exactly.
You know, do you have access to a circulator?
Wait till the potatoes cool off a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah, but do you have a circulator or no?
No, I'm pretty much working. I live in Brooklyn in this town. I don't even have a kitchen. I just
But if you just get a $7-$8 digital thermometer, you check the temperature of your potatoes right when you know before you want to serve them, and you fold that in to give it that, you know, just that folding technique. I think that would be great.
But just do it at the last minute.
Exactly.
I mean, if you have a circulator, you can cheat and spread it out in a Ziploc and go. But yeah, but just wait till the last minute.
Yeah,
last minute. And if
so
you
just do potatoes, season them up. You know, keep them, you know, starchy
warm,
whatever they are,
keep
and
them warm.
Fold that in at the very end.
Yeah, and use a ricers or potato mill to have your potato base, and then at the last second you fold it in with the right ratio, and that's something where you just keep on adding in just to get the right mouthfeel, and you just have to keep on tasting for that. Another cool thing that we love to do to increase the potato flavor as well, if you're using oil, that's a great medium for that. You can take the skins from the potatoes, the potato peels, obviously, that you've taken away from
peeled before.
Exactly. And fry them in the oil beforehand that you're going to use for your mayonnaise. So they have a beautiful, deep, nutty flavor. And then strain that, cool that down, make your mayonnaise like that, and then you'd have a really intensely flavored and creamy mashed potato.
Oh, cool.
That sounds great. What kind of frying on the like deep frying or just kind of
just in a pan, you know, and you have your skins in there and you wait until they get sort of, you know, crisped and golden. You don't want to burn them. You don't want to get any bitter flavors, but
until
you're extracting
oil or whatever.
Exactly, you're just extracting some of those really beautiful flavors.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, guys.
Well, good luck. Let us know how it works out.
Absolutely.
Do we?
Great. Yeah, I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, do we still have another caller? All right, caller, you are on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hi. Ooh, you got an echo.
Hi. Yeah.
An echo? Hold on a second. Is that any better?
Nah, no, we'll deal with it.
Hi, I'm a current student at SCI, actually, and I had a question kind of related to something I'm trying to do for my menu project.
Okay.
And so two questions. I need both to create food in large sheets, and also I'm asking about edible threads, if you know of anything.
Wait, large sheets of what? And
what was the...
Yeah, okay, so, for example, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to use is Yuba, which is easy enough to get into a large sheet, but I was also thinking about using transglutamase to bind thin slices of meat into large sheets.
Yes,
sure.
I guess, are you familiar with Shibori?
Shibori
is a Japanese resist dyeing technique, like a very badass form of tie dye, basically.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay.
And so the idea is to
is it silk screening or is it self? Yeah,
cleaning. I'm not sure. I guess so. My idea is taking foods and binding them using these resist techniques. We actually weave thread into the fabric and then pull it tight and bunch it in different designs, and then you dye it, and where the fabric is pulled tight, it resists the dyeing.
Right.
And
okay.
So the idea is to bind food, and then it would then resist different cooking methods through the different courses, either by taking like a sheet of sashimi, binding it very carefully and bunching it, and then soaking it in a like ceviche base so that the bound portions resist the acid. They aren't exposed to the acid, and so some of it comes out as sort of a ceviche cure, and then some of it comes out still as the sashimi, for example.
Okay.
I mean, looking for an edible thread that is fine enough to do that sort of work with something as delicate as fish, but that is still edible.
How strong? How strong? Like scallion comes to mind as the classic thread.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like
chives are
like long pieces that are then, you know, lightly blanched. I mean, that's right. The classic, yeah. You know, thing like that that works. I mean, I'm sure there's others.
I mean, you can do starch-based ones. I mean, that would be consist of making a starch paper based on like maybe a really good prehydrated tapioca starch. You make a leather, maybe a little bit of oil, so that the it breaks down in your mouth more easily. And I think that might be. I don't know, but then it might hydrate.
You'd have a tough time when it's in contact with the fish.
Okay,
so you need something waterproof, right? Which means that you're dealing with. I mean, that right there is a problem. So now you're basically down to long scale plant fibers.
Absolutely. Or you could do a gluten base, actually.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, can you make that strong enough?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've done it with pasta. We've done it where if you cut them just fine enough, you could do a very a fresh pasta enriched with about, depending on the flour you're using, 5 to 7% vital wheat gluten. And Bob's Red Mill is a really good brand. And you could get a very sort of, you know, elastic thread that would be, you know, very workable, but also break down as you chew very easily.
Can you hit it with RM to make it even tougher? Or no?
We've done that for buckwheat, because you had the protein content, but we didn't have enough of the starch.
Right.
So. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, the pasta would work very well with the meat course too. Yeah. Have you guys heard of collagen thread?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't break down so nicely though.
Mouth feels not so nice.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, well, think about it this way. I mean, collagen on the outside doesn't break down as nicely as like intestine, for instance.
Sure. Tripe would be cool.
That'd be cool. That would work.
Tripe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Honeycomb tripe is an amazing, yeah.
Yeah, or like long, like carefully cut pieces of sausage casing.
Yeah. That's
all great. Yeah.
And as for gluing sheets, it's no problem. That's no problem.
Yeah, that's
stuff's meant to do it. Here's my one recommendation. The only time I've ever had meat glue provide an off flavor in a dish that I've done was when I glued I glued many, many layers of different colored fish together and then vacuumed them together.
It looks so cool, though.
Well, no, but yeah, but so the first time I did it, I over-meat glued it and I vacuumed it and I let it cure in the vacuum bag. And then I perceived a flavor that, so the second time I did it, I used a much less amount of meat glue, vacuumed it, and then right after I crushed it into shape, I cut the bag open and then it could air out in the fridge while it was setting. So
I let that flavor come off.
Yeah.
Especially with fish, when I am butchering, before you put the sheets together, would you cut them across like you're doing for sashimi, or along the grain to kind of provide stability?
Any like thin, beautiful sheet of fish is going to be absurdly delicate, no matter how you do it.
Yeah.
Unless you're literally cutting in a big piece and then preserving the sinew along the cut, which is possible. Like we've done tuna sinew, is delicious. You know, but you're going to be tough getting big pieces. That stuff you could hit somebody in the face with; it won't break.
If you were to partially cure the meat. Then you might have, I mean, if you give it, not cure, I would actually do a brine, but if you were to do like a 3.5 salts percentage, you know, to water, 2% sugar brine, you might be able to get a little bit more elasticity and I think structure to the fish.
Yeah, I mean, the best way to slice, unless you're going to do some sort of special slicing, is to par freeze it. Don't freeze it all the way. Just get it par freeze, throw it on like a very high quality meat slicer, and go directly in between sheets of wax paper, and then keep them almost frozen until you're about to use them. Because once those things thaw out, good night.
And would the transglutamate still work while it's frozen, or would you apply it frozen and if it thaws, it would activate?
No, needs to thaw. Needs to thaw in order for the what you do is because when I was doing it, I would take the fairly stiff but not fully frozen sheets. I would layer them, and then as soon as the salt and the sugar from the cure hits them, they melt out, and then you have a block. But then you don't lift them again. That's it.
That's
you know
it.
What I mean?
That's
they're done.
yeah.
You know.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much.
And if you want to see a video, I have a video on cooking issues on the blog, mm-hmm. I think, or linked to from a Star Chef's video I did where I did mokumegane, which is the Japanese metalworking kind of technique. And you can see the kind of in practice, like thin sheets of fish glued together. It's not what you want to do, but it might give you some visual pointers on how to handle the products.
Yeah.
Excellent. And Thank you very much.
I'm really curious to see how this all comes together. This is send us some photos.
I will definitely send you guys some photos. I have a friend who does a lot of food photography who's very interested also, who wants to document it. So I will definitely send you guys something.
Awesome.
Cool.
Some photos and stuff. Yeah.
Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you. So do we have any more callers, or should we take some email stuff?
Let's do some emails, I think.
All right. Do some emails. Yeah, I heard there was someone, but I heard that, which means we lost him. Okay. Let's see. I'm probably, it's nice that we're getting some calls, which means I probably won't get to all of the email questions. Anything that I missed this week, I will try to get next week. Michael writes in about nutmeg. Here's a question. I recently ordered a set of food-grade essential oils from Aftelier, which is Mandy Aftel. Do you work with her over there?
I know she did work with Daniel Patterson for a while, and then that's...
Yeah, and she's good buddies with Harold McGee.
Absolutely.
And so she's basically a perfumer out of San Francisco or thereabouts, Bay Area.
Yeah.
And she does a lot of interesting stuff. And she actually has a line in Williams-Sonoma now that just launched, but I haven't seen it because I haven't been in Williams-Sonoma in like how long? I just don't go. You know what I mean? I'm forbidden to buy kitchen equipment, people, by the way. Like literally, if I brought another anything in my house. Yeah, right? I mean, anyway. So recently ordered a set of food-grade essential oils from Aftelier. Fun stuff, especially for those of us that don't have a Rotovap. Although Rotovap doesn't make essential oils. Just be clear on this. Rotovap does distillation, but not the steam distillation that is what happens when you're making essential oils. It's kind of a different piece of equipment. I don't do steam distillation because I don't have a rig for it. Anyway, you guys have the baller Rotovap, the huge one. Jeez, you know what?
The Bucci. Come hang out. Let's play.
You know what? The thing is like I say, like anything I would ever say about these guys is strictly due to jealousy, just straight up jealousy. All right.
Oh God.
Okay. So one of the items in my set is nutmeg essential oil. I seem to remember from reading Soul on Ice, which is I guess Eldridge Cleaver's book. That nutmeg was a popular prison hallucinogen with horrible side effects. So now I'm a little scared to use this stuff. Is there a chance that the hallucinogen is concentrated, or conversely, a reason to believe it was left behind, either one of those not in the oil, to make sure it's completely safe? Okay, look, the compound, there's several possible psychoactive compounds in nutmeg. One of them is myristicin, is the kind of famous one. Parsley seed oil has a lot of it. And if you go to Arrowhead, which is like the place where kind of... thinking druggies go to put down their kind of mental thoughts on this. This is where I go. Most of those people aren't using nutmeg. They're using parsley seed oil, which has a high concentration of this in various capsules. Listen, that compound, myristicin, is aromatic, and it's actually characteristic of nutmeg. So there is no way that you making a dish that you enjoy the taste of are going to get poisoned.
Yeah, the levels would be ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, people who typically to get a hallucinatory effect out of it, people will do things like grate a whole nutmeg or two, and then kind of like somehow choke it down, and it's described as the most vile thing that they've ever done in their lives. And then like 3 hours later, they start feeling some sort of psychoactive effects. This is not something that you would accidentally do.
Yeah.
Could you take that oil, pack it into gel caps, pound it, and do yourself harm? Yeah. I mean, one of the problems with nutmeg is that psychoactive substances are kind of the thing with them is there are certain psychoactive substances that that the danger level is fairly close to the psychoactive level, and I think nutmeg is closer than many in that kind of spectrum, which is kind of where the bad kind of rep comes from, because if you eat one grated nutmeg, you won't die, but if you eat like 3, like there might be renal failure or something like that. So it's like, and an order of 3 is not a safety level that most druggies would be happy with, between activity and death. Like it's not a happy number. Like an order of magnitude is a more friendly kind of a number. But anyways, don't worry about it. Like what I'm saying is don't worry about it.
A little grating here and there. Delicious.
Yeah. Also, apparently, and again from Arrowhead, the stuff degrades over time, similar to Thujone, which we're going to talk about in a minute with absinthe. And in other words, so if you use nutmeg that's old, it's lost some of its principle. So, you know, even if you somehow are able to, you know, choke down, you know, that jar of McCormick ground nutmeg that's in your grocery store.
Mostly gone.
Yeah, it's mostly gone. And you probably, not that I recommend it. So don't worry. Don't worry. Right?
Absolutely.
Don't worry. No. We might as well do this on a similar one. We have in from Tom Fisher in Lansdowne, PA, longtime listener. First of all, he has a centrifuge question. Let's knock that out first, right?
Okay, cool.
Okay, before we get to the Thujone.
Yep.
Got my centrifuge. Good. I'm glad to hear it. That's one of all of our favorite pieces of equipment. Yeah, centrifuge.
My baby.
Yeah, you're on the cutting edge, by the way. Like, in 15 years, many more high-quality restaurants are going to have centrifuges, and people won't think that you're a freak show when you suggest that they go get one.
Absolutely not. It's coming to homes, too. This is the next Cuisinart, you know.
Really? They're going to make one?
I think so. I think they were very curious about it yesterday, so let's see.
Really? Yeah. Oh, but by the way, before we get to this question, yesterday was the IACP. I didn't go because I had a bunch of events I had to do, but the award ceremony. And last year, Modernist Cuisine was about to come out, and I co-hosted with Chris Young, you know, one of the other authors. And I was telling him, joking, that next year, if you don't win every damned book award, you know, it's going to be a travesty. And in fact, you guys won three.
We won three.
Including one that they made up for you, right? Like, profound. What was it? Was it?
It was, it was like just like a future invention, or, you know, it was, they were very gracious, and we were very, very honored to receive these awards.
Bad year to write a different book. anyway, okay. In the cooking world, that is, okay. So, especially a professional book and or one that purports to have amazing photographs, because you're just going to get swamped. Anyway, okay. So, got a centrifuge and spun me some strawberries, but I have an issue. I tossed the strawberries in the blender, added 2 grams 2 grams of Pectinex Ultra SPL, which is a Pectinex enzyme, for 500 grams of strawberry. That's, you know, more dose than you need. You could probably do one in that amount, but two's not going to hurt you. You just don't want to put so much Pectinex in that it has a slightly fermented aroma, but that's fine. Don't worry about it. Blend it until slightly warm. Good practice. Rested 10 minutes. Good practice. 10 to 20, good practice. If you do something that's going to break down, like bananas, you don't want to rest it any longer than 10, because it'll start to get kind of brown flavors. And spun for 10 minutes. You don't say what speed. I'm assuming you have a centrifuge that'll do about 4,000 times the force of gravity. 10 minutes is on the edge. 10 to 15 is better at those speeds, just because it will clarify almost instantly, but the puck solidity is going to get a lot higher when you go faster. Okay, got a very solid puck and crystal clear juice. Glad to hear it. But on top was a layer of what appeared to be the same material as the puck, but floating on top like a vinegar mother. Scooping it out clouded the juice, but spinning for 5 minutes more cleared it up nicely. Is this result of air bubbles trapped in the mix? Yes. Yeah. If you have a vacuum machine, vacuum that sucker out, break it before and get the air out, no problem.
No problem.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, this is something that, you know, Maxime and I do every day. And glad to hear.
We've got it running all day.
Yeah. Ours actually is acting up. I have to get a new motor.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not
good. We had to replace the motor, too.
Yeah. If you're using a centrifuge that only goes up to about 4,000 Gs, the buckets really aren't. It's not like a hazard to life and limb, but your motors will have to be replaced eventually. It's about a $900 problem in the one we have. Anyway. Now, the second question, the different question. Absinthe. Years ago, when absinthe first became legal to sell in the U.S., I bought a bottle. And the maker seemed very energetic about saying it was free of contaminants like Thujone from the wormwood. It's not a contaminant. It's an ingredient. Contaminant. People are so crazy. All right.
It's the basis for absinthe.
Yeah, right? Anyway, yeah. It seemed all right, but nothing to write home about. More recently, a friend got a bottle and was telling me about it, saying it was made from the original illegal formula. I said I'd like to try. I said I'd tried the Thujone-free version years ago and laughed and said, Thujone-free absinthe is like alcohol-free rum. Thujone is what makes it special. So what's the real deal? Thanks for doing the show every week. Okay. So, look, Thujone is another purported hallucinogenic, psychoactive compound that is found in wormwood, which is it's the characteristic herb from, other than the anise taste,
right.
From absinthe. And all of the later ones, like, not later, but different ones like Pernod, not their their regular one, or Ricard or Pastis or any one of these southern French, like I'm a small man in Marseille drinking stuff. Not small, but old. I don't mean small and physically.
It's delicious.
Yeah, it's good. But it's especially good in the summer in Marseille when you're sitting out. You know what I mean? Marseille is a great town,
nice
by the way.
Nice and cold and...
Yeah. Yeah, Marseille, fantastic town. I really like it. Anyway, point is that Thujone, there's a lot of research out there. The one that you should go look at, again, you can get to it via Arrowhead Vaults, but there's a bunch of papers out there where they studied old pre-ban absinthe bottles and found that modern absinthe has roughly similar levels to older absinthe, that the longer that and that's not really high enough to get you cranked up on Thujone by itself unless you drank so much that the ethanol is going to have you stumbling and falling over. So is there some sort of synergism between like the smaller amount of Thujone that's actually in absinthe and, you know, who knows? Who can tell? But like most of the studies that have been done, quantitative studies out there, point to the fact that really what's happening is you're getting drunk. Horribly drunk. Especially if you're trying to see how much absinthe it takes you to have a Thujone effect, you're going to be plastered. Plus, there's the placebo effect. Right. The other thing is that wormwood, Thujone quantity in wormwood, and this has also been checked, goes down radically as it's stored on drying. So if you have your own wormwood or other Artemis species sitting around and you then take it right away and make absinthe, you're going to have much higher Thujone levels than if you take a commercially prepared one that you get in an herb shop that's been dried and sitting around for a year, and you're going to get a much lower quality of Thujone quantity. But even so, the numbers seem to indicate that you're not going to get crunked on the Thujone, that you're going to get shellacked by the ethanol. Now, Thujone is it oregano or sage oil? It's one of those two. Go look it up on the internets. And it's super high in Thujone. I'm not telling you to go take this, right? But if you need to know what Thujone goes like, go get a proper dose response relationship off of the internets. Any one of these herbal drug sites has many, many users who have put this stuff in. Make sure that you don't listen to anyone that doesn't tell you like relative quantities in different oils and also body weight phenomena, things like this, because you want to get your doses right. And I've never tried it. But you know what? I've tried other things that people have supposed psychoactive effects. Like, for instance, when I was in Colombia, we were doing coca leaf infusions with coca leaf tea.
Nice.
And I've never done cocaine, so I don't know what that's like. I didn't feel anything different, but I had people who had a lot more than I did report that it kept them up at night, for instance. So there was – but a lot of this
– extra energy.
Right, but a lot of this could just be mental. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Just placebo. If you tell someone you're having coca leaf infusion
– no, there's an excitement. There's a psychological reaction, which is –
Yeah. Anyway. Okay, let's take one more commercial – do we have time to take one more commercial break? All right, let's take one more commercial break. Call your questions to 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Cooking issues.
Let it rain.
And welcome back to Cooking Issues. By the way, I'm not Angela Gabatz, one of my favorite interns of all time, wrote in from Nebraska, but I'm not going to have time to get your question this time. I'm going to get you next time, Angela. All right, on to the last question of the day, and I really want to talk about this with Maxime because it's something I think that he's probably interested in. Steve Crandell writes in, have you seen the paper, this interesting paper, on food pairing hypothesis, and it's called Flavor Network and the Principles of Food Pairing by Yang Yeol An et al. Okay, and it was a paper last year by a bunch of people out of a bunch of different institutions. Anyway, so what I haven't had a chance really to have Maxime look at the paper.
Yes.
So we're not going to talk specifically about the paper, more about just the general concept of it. But the basic concept of food pairing has been popular over the last, the decade or so?
Decade? 15 years. I mean, really.
You know, and it's something that, at the Fat Duck you're exposed to a lot. Yeah. And the basic premise is that you can get, and it's controversial, and Maxime and I, we've never discussed it together, so we might violently disagree, which would be an awesome way to end the show. but the basic principle is that you can learn something about food pairings or get interesting food pairing ideas by looking at the actual chemical similarities between different food items.
Common threads.
And so what happens is there's large databases of what flavor components are in various different ingredients, and then those are analyzed. And the Fat Duck was famous for which ones?
The white chocolate and caviar both had a very similar volatile component, and it was very interesting.
Was it good?
I actually never had it.
Really?
I knew the idea. Then I had a cocoa and roasted cauliflower, also both shared a compound. And that was it's a beautiful marriage, and it makes no sense in sort of a traditional context. But when you taste it together, you realize that there is definitely value to approaching it that way. I don't think it's as consistent and as secure of an approach that people will presume when they're really getting into this approach.
The study, which you should read, is actually quite interesting. What they've done is they've taken a bunch of recipe databases, and then they've analyzed the recipe databases to see whether, when you scan across many thousands of recipes, is there more often than not shared ingredient flavor components or not?
A pattern, right?
And in the Western corpus, there was, and it was correlated that more than the statistically random amount of recipes shared flavor components.
Right.
And in their East Asian data analysis, fewer than the statistically number of shared ones would. But what it boiled down to, the really interesting thing is that basically what it is that 75% of the recipes they pulled in Western cuisine shared a very small number of flavor, a small number of ingredients,
sure.
And those ingredients shared a lot of things like butter, milk, like a lot
right,
of the,
right,
yeah.
It's very simple,
Right, and the six most common, Asian ingredients didn't share a lot of characteristics, and so because those things basically weighted everything out, and all of the other recipes, if you remove the most common, 6 to 10 ingredients out of our toolkits, then it's basically statistically random in terms of that, which is interesting.
Absolutely.
Here's my personal feeling about it is that anything that gives you an idea that's going to make you that's going to give you a good flavor, then fine, do it. Whether it's like throwing dice, using a dowsing rod, whatever in the hell it is, if it gives you a good idea, it's good. But that nothing in the world, there's no chemical analysis is going to replace your memory, your taste palate, what you've done before. Like, you might get an idea and then try it and then know how to tweak it, but there is no substitute for having tasted a lot and having cooked a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to sort of, it's interesting that the parallel between Western cuisine and Eastern cuisine and how we're noticing that these correlations. What I think is really interesting about Eastern cuisine in this sense is that, taking away the sort of chemical balance of a few ingredients is the balance of flavor. And what I love about Eastern cuisine is that now we're talking about flavor. I mean, the tastes, salty, bitter, sweet, acid, and paying less attention to this sort of artificial combination of things that, that may have a synergy or not.
Right.
And so if when you build a sense, when you build your palate, the balance of flavors is, you know, through practice becomes a very inherent part of your, you know, culinary experience. And a lot of these things may be more confusing or misleading.
Right, but I think what happens is with anything else, look, the people who are using these kinds of ideas, right, or, you know, in modernist cuisine, using new pieces of equipment, new techniques, whatever, these are usually, in general, a very highly creative set of people, and they're looking for inspiration.
Yeah.
Like, and I've said this many times, like the fundamental thing that Ferran gave us was the desire to look outside of the normal kitchen for our inspiration.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And that's the thing. It's not foams or whatever. It's this intense curiosity and this love of learning. And so as cooks do this, they're looking for very different and disparate sources of inspiration. And is this idea of different chemical shared things, could that be a source of inspiration?
Of course.
Sure.
Of course.
Sure.
Of course.
But someone who doesn't have the palate to back it up, doesn't have the experience to back it up, it will be confusing, as you say.
And it can be a disaster.
A horrible disaster. Horrible.
Yes.
So why don't we end this show on horrible disaster? Thank you, Maxime. Thank you, Donna.
Absolutely. Thank
Nastasha.
You, Dave.
See you next week on Cooking Issues.
All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Vicious vodka.